It was a buzzy reception.
What's that?
And it made the photographs lining the walls seem eerily quiet. The opening night of Maxime Donyuk's White Series in Toronto rightfully celebrated a photographer who has put his body and his camera onto the front lines of this war. The White Series features photos of eastern Ukraine in wintertime, unharvested sunflower fields, a bombed-out tank abandoned in a leafless forest, a Soviet war monument pockmarked by more recent artillery fire. They sound so depressing as I describe them, but these photos don't bring you down. They pull you in. All of these ravaged relics of war captured by Maxim under a dusting of undisturbed snow, gazing back at us Torontonians that night, with our glasses of white wine in hand and a comforting distance.
Коли дійдеш до краю і ступиш за край, і поглине пітьма золовою.
You're listening to Kultura Rising, and I'm Andrew Kushner. When I came back to the gallery a few days later, it was now empty, outside of me, Maxim, and preeminent contemporary photographer Edward Bertinsky, who had brought Maxim's work to Canada. With only the three of us in the room, the White Series photographs felt altogether different. They weren't subdued or shy anymore. Not to me, at least. In fact, each photo felt pretty insistent, demanding even, testifying to something unbearably loud that had happened in wartime. And then, maybe the thing I heard most clearly from these photographs, a longing for people to lovingly come back, to replant the trees, to repair or make this a place for peaceful human existence again.
I just don't want to like make a picture where you just see immediately what happened. It's so easy and so simple. And I believe that people are smart, and I want to just give them chance to just start thinking and feel. And also it's about feeling. And it's like question. It's again.
I don't know who I was expecting Maxim to be, the photographer behind this work, someone hard, as battle-worn as his landscapes, right? I had read the 2023 piece for The New Yorker that Maxim had collaborated on. He got in trouble for that one, having represented too truthfully, too starkly, the state of Ukraine's infantry on the eastern front line. He's the photographer who, for that magazine, took a close-up shot of two hands, one cradling the other. Out of context, you'd think they were the resting hands of a farmer. The soil so deeply melded, so permanently baked into the skin. But these are the hands of a soldier who spends day in and day out in modern trench warfare. The dirt is so integrated into these hands that you wouldn't be able to differentiate between the land or the human, even if you tried. Photographer Ed Bertinsky has this to say as he looks upon Maxim's photos.
Here, this is a weapon of death and destruction. Now been destroyed in the war, and it's sitting in this forest, but the forest has also been destroyed. So, you know, nature suffers, and then it's just like, that's the theater of war, is the forest and nature, and you see that it is hurting, and it's in pain as well. It just leaves a path of sorrow. But again, knowing what we do know...
This blurred line between land and people is at the heart of Edward Bertinsky's work, too. Arguably Canada's most successful and recognizable contemporary photographer, I've been a fan of his for a very, very, very long time, Edward's work asks us to feel into what he calls, quote, the other side of our lives. Where our lithium batteries come from, our potash and coal, the energy that makes our world, what makes our modern comforts and conveniences possible. And what the cost of that looks like on the face of our planet. Both Ed and Maxim dare to put edges on the edgeless so that we can turn towards the things that scare us, rather than pretend they're not happening, rather than being utterly overwhelmed by them. The monolith of the climate catastrophe, the monolith of war, what we can't bear to look at, until someone helps us look. When I met Maxim for the first time in his tan-colored linen and sporting a long beard, I really couldn't square his gentleness and his easy smile with what he has seen through his camera. He laughed about how at the nearby grocery store in Toronto, some brand of buckwheat went by the name of kasha, the Ukrainian word for buckwheat. And so he felt that in Canada, Ukraine was all around us. And when I catch Ed looking at Maxim, it's so clear that he's found a kindred spirit. Two men who can't stop themselves from taking photographs, these kinds of photographs, and to tell the truth as they see it. Not the kinds of images we can swipe through easily in our news feeds. The kind that ask us to slow down, listen, and to formulate, if only in our hearts, a response. This is photographers Maxim Donyuk and Ed Bertinsky. I interviewed them in Ed's office in Toronto. I didn't realize that there was so much color in these photos until I took the time to be with them. And was that your intention, Maxim, to, you know, it's called the White Series. Is that mischievous?
It's white color for me. It's about emptiness. And I just, when I started working on this series, I just was traumatized after war and feel a lot of emptiness and sadness inside of me. So it's like a landscape story, but it's also like portrait story about what people feel inside. And white for me, it was so important because for me, it's like emptiness and beginning something new.
I feel the beginning in it. And it sometimes felt like we were a part of that beginning, that you were inviting us to not forget or not miss out on these parts of Ukraine, on these parts of Ukraine that perhaps feel abandoned or perhaps feel so damaged that they can never be returned to. So I felt you were building a bridge for us, you know, as the viewer. I want to ask you both how you met.
I was doing some work and fundraising for the Ukrainian war, and I was doing some writing, and I wrote a piece for the Maclean's magazine, which, by the way, got me barred from going back to Russia. So I was on the no-go list to Russia, which I was fine with.
Right.
But then the thing I really wanted to do was to find an artist working with photography. Immediately, Maxim's work just jumped out at me, and I think it was the White Series that really got me excited as well. And then, you know, we did end up collaborating at Baba Yar, and he did some work for me there. There's a synagogue that was built there as a representation for the loss of the Jewish life that happened in the Holocaust, and how Ukraine and how Baba Yar was the place of the scene of the crime.
Baba Yar was a ravine, right?
It's in Kyiv. Yeah, well, like Nazi just kill a lot of Jewish people, and it's like a lot of tree and valley, so it's like so. Yeah, big place, and now it's like nature park, yeah.
Yeah, I've done a tour of it. I did a tour of Baba Yar in 2019, and if you didn't know what had happened there, you would think, oh, I'm in a park.
Yeah.
It's a city park.
Just park.
And so you collaborated on photos.
That. Yeah, that was showed at the Koffler Center. And so they asked me to go, and the war had just started, and it was inconvenient, and I didn't have a big timeline, and so then I reached out to Maxim, and only to realize that he was working with the same camera that I'm working with. Yeah, this camera, it's a Fuji camera. And then—
Is that unlikely?
Well, it's not a lot of people have adopted it. Yeah, it's not.
It's like just, for me, I just all the time work with, before 35 millimeters camera. But when I start working with more landscape, people see that I work with 35 millimeters, like with middle format, and they ask just, you should to buy a camera. And I say, it's so expensive. I even didn't know about Fuji. And after somebody recommend me, and I just start working with this camera when Ed called me, and I say, oh, I have this similar camera. Like, yeah.
It's a sign.
Yeah. So then I went and I said, could, instead of commissioning me, can we commission Maxim? And then he started going through and he did pictures with his iPhone and had a whole path and where he took all the pictures. And then I looked at them. And then in a way, we were collaborating, and that Maxim was kind of working with me to be an extension of what I think I would do if I was there.
So this is happening in real time, or is Maxim showing you proofs?
No, this is in real time. So he's there, he's showing me stuff. I'm saying, go back and shoot more of this. And so I'm directing and trying to get him to the place where I think is how to represent this sadness. And then again, the same kind of, so we're looking for snow and the same kind of ideas. We had a little bit of snow, but we were looking at the same idea of kind of going to the scene of the crime, but after it happened, right? It's kind of, how do you make that space speak to this atrocity that occurred. So when I saw Maxim's work, I thought he would be the perfect collaborator to be there on the scene and to be kind of the extension of what I was trying to do, what I would have probably done had I been there.
Right. When you look at the results of the Babinyar collaboration, how do you see, Maxim, your work different than what it might have been? And I suppose, Ed, how did you see your work different than it might have been?
For me, it felt completely in keeping with, you know, my sense of sentiment, and as is the White Series here. And that was one of the things I think I saw in Maxim, was that it's a more thoughtful, and I said implicit and inward kind of, you know, arriving at the subject through your heart and through feeling versus like an intellectualization of it. Mm-hmm. You know, you want to make that person engage with that subject, and it's only upon reflection does the kind of, you know, reality emerge of what it is. And there is suffering and there is tragedy in the reality.
And Maxim, how about you? How did this collaboration impact your perspective or your practice?
When Ed called to me or write to me during war, I was so surprised, because I just like, oh, great. Yeah. And it was so, and it's like means a lot for me, because I just realized that what I'm doing, more poetic, more think, is somebody notice it, and it's so important. And when we start to work with Babi Yar, for me, it was not so hard, because when we talk about photography, how I should make photography, for me, it was the same thing, that was like someone with more experience, but with the same thinking about photography and feeling, and continue doing this wide series, because I begin it before in 35 millimeters. And this, it's like with middle format, it's much more deep and different. And also about quality with this panorama, you can see this big size, and you can just go and see all this tree, benches, tank, all this thing, and see all detail. You just feel this, I don't know, emptiness. So it's like no people, no action, because it's also emptiness.
Yeah. That's something that somebody said to me next to me on Wednesday night. They said, look at all of this painful detail. They said painful detail. And I'm struck, you know, Ed, in your work, be it manufacturing landscapes, all these sort of extraordinary images of human impact on our planet, what resource extraction looks like, what it takes to power our phones and warm our homes. I'm struck by this notion of truth. And do you ever look at your photos respectively and you go, wow, there's maybe too much truth here. This is overwhelming.
There are certain qualities that I look for in my work. And one is what creates a visually compelling image. And it's not necessarily in search of beauty. It's in search of archetypes in a way that capture our imagination. If you just show the explicit, a dead soldier blown apart, and you go, oh my God, I can't look, you avert your eyes. But what has that done? You've gone, it's sensational and it's terrible. And of course, we wouldn't want to see anybody that we know have that done to them. And so there is a kind of an empathy, but it's almost pornography. It's too much. You know, it's just like, it doesn't help us. You know, there's no subtlety to it.
Yeah. You don't refer to it as you're not trying to confront us. It seems the word is meditation. Yeah. You want us to meditate on war. What does that mean to you?
I think the whole art contain feeling. Like if we talk about music or poem or a good movie, it's about feeling. It's not a lot of information sometimes. It's more about feeling, reflection. And I think it's so important in photography, just try to put all this emotion. Because I think artists should criticize some problems, speak about a serious question, but people so lazy don't want to just see some problem or something like this. So sometimes we use this trick, making like beauty picture, using this all language, visual language, and people just see, oh, it's nice. And when they go and close, they start to realize about what happens here.
Yeah. It's not just about meditation. It's about taking that time and slowing down to be with the image. But I also hear the word rumination. What is it to get people to actually think after they've felt something and to walk away from the space. You said some folks said haunting, right, Ed? The images are haunting. What is to be haunted? It's to carry beyond a space, a feeling, a question, a desire to know more.
Yeah.
I think that's very, when I think of the kinship, what both of your bodies of work do to me, I think of that. That I keep thinking about and I keep feeling about what I've seen beyond being in front of the photo. I want to ask you about your beginnings. So, Ed, when were you born?
When was I born?
As a photographer.
As a photographer. Well, I think my first moment with camera in hand and taking pictures of the world, I was 11. But then I don't think I really hit my stride as a photographer until I kind of started hitting my first and second years of university. I was already starting to find where I was going with it. So that would have been 1976, 77, 78. So I was already kind of moving towards this idea that, you know, I was raised in Ukrainian Catholic, and then at 12 or 13, like happens to a lot of kids, I kind of started to move away from religion. I was a little disillusioned with it, and I was thinking, starting to have my own critical thinking around it. And I also believed inertly inside, I felt that as I moved away from religion, because I was like an altar boy, I was like seriously into religion. But then as I moved away from it, I still was in search of meaning, something to describe, how to describe the crazy world that I'm living in, and the cyclical things that I see, and the, you know, where do you find meaning in all of that?
Right.
And, you know, my father died when I was young, so he was already, you know, full of cancer when he was 40. So at 10, he was already diagnosed. And by the time I was 15, he had died, and I became the eldest male in the family. But it's in all that, I was always having to be self-reliant. I had to always had jobs. I always made my own money. But photography was always this thing. And my father came from an artisanal town and outside of Lviv, a town called Kosiv, and they all were artisans. And my I think his family were, they painted ceramics and fired ceramics for backsplashes for kitchens and things like that. So it was all hand painting. And so he was a painter. And so that kind of creative need to create was it somehow in my DNA. And so even at 15, I said, I just want to be an artist. I just want to make things. I feel alive when I'm bringing things into the world. And if I stop doing it, I feel like I just wither. I'm just somehow disappearing and life becomes meaningless. So it's in me. I have no choice but to make things or wither.
Mm-hmm.
And so that drive. And then I also felt that as an artist, you know, is there life after death or not? And that was always a question as a kid, you know, is this all for naught? And then you die and it all goes black. But I thought, well, the only way you have any kind of way to kind of carry on is the marks you leave behind in your life. That is your immortality, that leaving marks and leaving interesting marks is a way to kind of defy death, you know? And I was having those thoughts when I was like 15 and 16, you know? So I always just wanted to be an artist. And so everything went to that direction.
Maxim, when did you get your start in photography?
But it's like, because I just like started making picture when I was child, because my parents, I just remember they just present me cameras when I was six. But when collapsed Soviet Union, I stopped taking any picture because it was different problem. I couldn't find negatives or something like this. And in 24, I returned to photography. And in beginning career until 2014, until revolution Ukraine, I work like documentary photographer and focusing for some social problem like classical documentary photographer. But in revolution, it's something changed inside of me, and I start to see reality in different way, more poetic, and I just stop focusing about what, where, what happening, and just start thinking about different way of photography. And I just all the time care about not what important, what touch me.
Ed, you've written about this publicly before, what your mother survived, the Holodomor, Nazi occupation. She was, in fact, enslaved and had to work in Germany, is that right?
Yep.
How did that show up in your upbringing?
Well, she was a tough lady. She survived a lot. She, you know, she took no prisoners. She was like, if I didn't, you know, do something, or she was hardcore. My father was really hardcore, too, so very high discipline, consequential raising, and it wasn't easy as a kid. You know, it wasn't there was no coddling to be had. I mean, I think we went the other extreme in the next generation, over-coddled them, but we were maybe a little under-coddled.
Right. It's a pendulum.
It's a pendulum.
Yeah.
But also I saw in my father the kind of damages of war, and he, I think, saw some fighting and, you know, and he wasn't like a lot of those men, they carried those traumas with them, and it showed up in, you know, the family, and they weren't always the best guys. They were damaged in many ways. And so, and he was also, I realized, a frustrated artist. He was 16 and he was taken from an artisanal town where his whole future was already predetermined. And now he probably had to, you know, do things that he didn't want to do. And he was taken away from a life that he had and never to return home. And that's not a unusual story, I don't think, of what happened after the Second World War.
War redirects life. And it, you know, it's clear in my own upbringing that being Ukrainian Canadian is to be touched by war. To be Ukrainian is certainly to be touched by war. Some people say to be Ukrainian is war, that Ukrainians have become war by virtue of what these last few years have inflicted on us.
But Ukrainian connection with war, like 300 years, it's all the time. We have neighborhood like Russia, even like Poland and Lithuania and Turkey. It's all the time like Ukrainian nation try to survive and try to resist of all another bigger country which wanna just take some part of our land.
Yeah.
The whole history. It's like fighting, yeah.
I think that brings up some heartache for me. Your white series makes me think, this aggressor has come and fought for this land and put mines into the soil and destroyed the livelihoods of those who lived there. And now it's virtually untouchable. I think of your Chernobyl series also.
My brother grew up 1 year after Chernobyl and 7 years be in the hospital. And my parents all the time say it's because of him, because Chernobyl, because everything. I just live with this. And after I decide, okay, maybe I need to go and see what is this place, which not destroying my family, but make a lot of problem to my family. And the same with war. I'm not to choose to go somewhere like war. I'm just not war photographer, and I just anti-war photographer, even if I just make something in the war, because I never want to just go to another country and cover conflict. I just even don't know what people think about this, why they going. And it's happening in my city, like revolution, like war. It's destroying my land. It's occupied my hometown. And I just like making project which it's like object or situation touching me important, and it's just like screaming. I want to like spread my emotion. I want to share this emotion. I'm not like going to psychologist or just talking to someone. I care about this, and I look in way of how I can just share all the things through photography.
Did I hear you correctly? Did you say you're an anti-war photographer?
Yeah, I'm just never just say that I'm war. I hate these things like war photographer, or just because I hate war. I just spend a lot of time in war, and I dream that all war just finish, and I want to just people hate war and not like it, not just even in this white picture, just people see that what could happen with any country if we make war, because in the end it's everything destroyed.
Do both of you see your work as activist? Or is that something that is your work labeled as activist?
Well, it's not overtly activist. I mean, hopefully, in many ways, you know, we've now inherited a very polarized world, you know, of left and right and rich and poor, and those are religious and those are non-religious. And so we have these kinds of hardening camps in all those categories. And for me, you know, I'm not trying to be an advocate for any individual camp of that kind of, you know, rich, poor, religious, non-religious, or left or right. That to me, I'm interested in kind of making works that sit within a more, like I said, within an archetypal space, within a central space where you can come from any of those directions and look at it. And it works on, I believe, a human level, not necessarily a political level. And so it's in the world of a more philosophical, and that's where I think the landscape is a neutral point. People say, why don't you spend, as Maxim said, why don't you spend more time focusing on the people? But the people are specific, and you can say, well, that's not me, that's another culture. But landscape, there's our collective values. There's a church. Well, people came together, communities. They took the money that they made from their fields and bought the bricks and built the church because they believed in something. That bridge, they all took the taxes to build the bridge. So these are all things that we have built as a collective, collaborative society, working together to make things that benefit all of us. And when you destroy those things, there's a more universal kind of story being told, you know, that it isn't just one person who died and you can empathize for that person and the family that had it, but, you know, it's there and we get it, we understand it, but it leaves us kind of with nowhere to go. You know, it's like, okay, I now absorbed it and that's a terrible thing.
They contain the tragedy in a way.
Yeah.
And you can stand outside.
Here, it's kind of like, well, what's happened and why did this happen? Who did this? And why was that church destroyed? You know, like whose benefit was that? And, you know, when, what was the aggression that made that happen? And so I think there's, and hopefully in that kind of more universal storytelling that you can do through the landscape and through that kind of image making, you know, if there are those who are able to kind of, you know, can you expand the tent so that, you know, those who don't believe or you understand that this is something that we as humans share collectively, and that can you expand the tent? Can you break down these kind of hardened positions and get people to understand, yeah, well, then maybe there is something happening to the environment and to the climate, or yes, there is a lot of consequences to a war and there's a lot of pain and a hurt and there's a lot of things get destroyed, not just lives, but also the place where they derive their lives, you know? And so there, it opens more questions, more ways, more inflection points for conversations, for bringing us together versus things that push us apart.
It's occurring to me, and I think this is a quote that I absorbed a long time ago, and it's, I think, your quote, Ed, around wanting your work to be like a reflection pool.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
So it's our mirror images. It's a mirroring who we are and where our collective values come together. And whether I'm looking at nature as the, you know, nature is suffering around the world based on human expansion, technology, and all of that. So, you know, there's a war going on and nature's losing and we're winning. And, you know, until we make a peace and let nature coexist with us, do we actually have a sustainable world? And until we find that peace, we're at risk of destroying, you know, the world for future generations. That's what we're facing right now. We're the only generation that ever faced that. And we know we're facing that. So we're now saying, what we do today, the future will look back at and say, what did you do once you knew that the planet was going over the top and wasn't going to make life sustainable, or we can't grow crops anymore, or we can't live here anymore, it's a desert now, or the floods are so bad it wipes us out every so often and we can't build because it's too unstable. So all those things are coming to us. And so I'm trying to be there as a kind of sending signals out there saying, we need to understand that this is a very dangerous thing we're doing and we need to make peace. We have to make peace with nature. We have to make peace with each other or the future is at risk.
I just want to ask you both, and you can address this literally. I think there are literal answers to this, but also maybe philosophically, what makes your respective bodies of work, the way you see the world, fundamentally Ukrainian?
I think just all artists too connected with their culture, because when you live in some place and when just like all your art, everything what you do is so connected with this culture, and it's like because you just cannot like take yourself from this culture and say, oh, I just do something independently because I think like this. No, it's a whole generation, whole Ukrainian history just inside of you, and all your feeling about this, all your knowledge, all your society just working with you, and you like just mirror all this history, think like you just like not like only try to make something what you feel, it's about many generation. And I think it's really connection, and I think it's really important, because sometimes young artists go to America or France or Germany and forgot about their culture and try to make something so important to Parisian or to London or to New York and forgot about them because they want to make name or money or be famous, but they lost themselves. And you cannot follow this way because you feel nothing about maybe this culture, but you can say a lot and do a lot about your culture.
We come from somewhere.
Yeah.
Exactly, yeah.
As is my tradition, at the end of every interview, I ask my guests to recommend a piece of Ukrainian or Ukrainian-Canadian art or an artist for us to seek out. Here's what Ed and Maxim said.
The one that I keep thinking of that came out of Canada that I had a lot of affinity with is William Kurelek. And if any Ukrainians haven't seen his work, they should see his work. He, you know, created a series of paintings that I think really were, I think, his own way. And I think artists often do this. It is a form of taking your own trauma and your own, you know, pain and turning it to meaning and finding ways in which other people can connect to it.
And how about you, Maxim?
Matvey Weisberg. He's really great painter, and he just work on this kind of abstraction things, and he make amazing work called Wall. Yeah, during revolution, he just go to Maidan and see everything that happened, and return to studio and make like kind of abstraction during like 10 minutes, and after he just put the whole wall. We be in London together in exhibition. It's like amazing, but he make a lot of good work.
That's painters William Kurelek and Matvey Weisberg, as recommended by my guests today, Ed Bertinsky and Maxim Donyuk. Kultura Rising is written and hosted by yours truly, Andrew Kushner. Allison Broverman is our senior producer. Pippa Johnstone is our executive producer. Mixing and sound design by Mark Angley. Original music by Daughters of Donbass, featuring Marichka. Podcast graphics by Nicholas Luchak. This has been an original podcast from the Shevchenko Foundation, Canada's premier national charitable foundation for Ukrainian-Canadian arts, heritage, and culture since 1963. Here's a little bit more about it.
My name is Jen Budney, and I am Executive Director and CEO of the Ukrainian Museum of Canada in Saskatoon. The Shevchenko Foundation has been very important to us at the museum, less because of the scale and more because of alignment. What I value just as much as the financial support that we get from the Shevchenko Foundation are the conversations I have with Shevchenko Foundation leadership and staff. The people at Shevchenko really are colleagues. They understand the pressures that cultural organizations are under, and they engage with the work that I do here in an intellectually generous way. My hope for Ukrainian culture in Canada is that it continues to be taken seriously. We've seen a much greater interest in Ukrainian culture, history, and Ukrainian heritage in Canada since the onset of Russia's full-scale invasion. I hope that we continue to be seen as a culture and a community that can engage with the present and with complex issues and difficult questions. Ukrainian culture here has always evolved in conversation with our surroundings and with other cultural groups, and I hope that we keep leaning into that.
I hope you'll join us next time, and that you'll keep showing up on the cultural front. Slava Ukraini!